There's a time and a place for a fillet of fish. But breakfast is for sausage biscuits. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
This message comes from Greenlight. Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on what your kids are spending with real-time notifications. Join millions of parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get started risk-free at greenlight.com/iHeart.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code iHeart or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
In May of 2005, what should have been a celebratory graduation trip for one young woman, the start to a new life as an adult, would turn out to be the start of a new life as a missing person. As Natalie Ann Holloway would go missing, her story and what happened on that fateful trip remain a mystery to this day. That's today on The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Natalie Ann Holloway was an 18-year-old American woman whose mysterious disappearance made international news after she vanished on May 30th, 2005, near the end of a high school graduation trip to Aruba in the Caribbean. Holloway lived in Mountain Brook, Alabama, and graduated from Mountain Brook High School on May 24th, 2005. Days before the trip, her disappearance resulted in a media sensation in the United States and remains unsolved. Holloway was scheduled to fly home from the Caribbean island on May 30th, 2005, but she failed to appear for her flight. She was last seen by her classmates outside of Carlson Charlie's, a restaurant and nightclub. She was in a car with local residents Jordan Vandersloot and brothers Deepak and Satish Kelpo. When the three men were questioned, they said that they dropped off Holloway at her hotel and denied knowing what had become of her. Upon further investigation by authorities, Vandersloot was arrested twice on suspicion of involvement in her disappearance, and the Kelpools were each arrested three times. Due to lack of evidence, the three suspects were released each time without being charged with the crime. Holloway's parents criticized Arubian police for their lack of progress in the investigation and interrogation of the three men who were last seen with their daughter. The family also called for a boycott of Aruba, which gained Alabama Governor Bob Riley support, but failed to gain widespread backing. With the assistance of hundreds of volunteers, Arubian investigators conducted an extensive search and rescue recovery operation. American special agents from the FBI, 50 Dutch soldiers, and three specially equipped Dutch Air Force F-16 aircraft participated in the search. In addition to the ground search, divers searched the ocean for Holloway's body. Her remains were never found. On December 18, 2007, Arubian prosecutors announced that the case would be closed without charging anyone with a crime. The Arubian prosecutor's office reopened the case on February 1st, 2008, after receiving video footage of Vandersloot under the influence of marijuana, saying that Holloway died on the morning of her disappearance and that a friend had disposed of her body. Vandersloot later denied that what he said was true in the interview, said that he had sold Holloway into sexual slavery. He later retracted his comments. In January of 2012, Vandersloot was convicted of the May 30th, 2010 murder of 21-year-old Stephanie Flores Ramirez in Lima, Peru. At the request of Natalie's father, Alabama Judge Alan King declared Holloway legally dead on January 12th of 2012. So, today on the Dark Side of Wikipedia, we're going to dive into this case. If you were around at the time, this was quite a media storm. It was one of the first, I would say, coming out of 9/11 media storms that were focused on an individual case that was, you know, somewhat sensational. It was focused on one individual. You know, it wasn't like a mass tragedy event or anything like that, but obviously a tragedy nonetheless. But right after 9/11, really all those things kind of went to the side for quite some time. And then this one kind of popped up and caught everyone's interest. And I don't know. I mean, it's a weird way of saying it, but kind of put the circle of news magazine and media sensation stuff almost back on track, I would say. On track as whatever type of fucked up track that is. But it almost kind of was a bit of a return to norm of we're going to obsess about someone we don't know and probably can't help in the crime, but we're all going to argue about it online type thing. So there's many of MySpace conversations, I think, had about the Natalie Holloway case back in the day. What are your recollections, Sean, joining us on today's episode?
When we first talked about doing this episode and I looked at the picture of her, I can't believe that was 15 years ago.
I know.
I do remember insane coverage of this, and every morning, every day, and the latest news, there is no news. And then basically it would just be the same news read that she went there and she was Mr. Flight and... Mm-hmm. It's amazing how something and how these gentlemen could get arrested three times.
Yeah.
And due to lack of evidence, and then this person was convicted of a murder. I mean,
yeah.
Come on. Wow. But 15 years ago is really what rung out that something that seems that happened a hell of a lot more recent than 15 years ago.
It's been a wild 20 years.
You know? A wild 20 days.
Yeah. And that too. And it makes me wonder, you know, because when I say back to a norm, we're not in that norm anymore. We're not in that average space anymore. So when cases like this pop up, I don't know how long it's going to take, you know, and not that it's a good thing by any means. But, you know, as humans do, they eventually need an escape from whatever is being constantly pushed at them as negative news, when it is, in fact, you know, negative news. And sometimes more negative news is the escape because it's not directly affecting them. And I think that's kind of what the Natalie Holloway case did for a lot of people when they could turn their attention to obsessing over this case rather than Al-Qaeda or a war or things of that nature back at that point in time. And it's a perfect recipe for a very intriguing case too, where you have the people that are questioned, they don't know anything, they're released, they admit to it, they're released, they murder somebody else. I mean, it's a screwed up story. So it's understandable why it gained so much traction and there was so much interest in this case. You know, starting 15 years ago as of this air date, but even to this day, still. Unsolved. Makes you wonder if we'll have another chapter at some point on this. Let's continue on with the story and go into the background here on the Dark Side of Wikipedia on the entry on the disappearance of Natalie Holloway. Holloway was the first of two children born to Dave and Elizabeth Holloway in Memphis, Tennessee. Her parents divorced in 1993, and she and her younger brother Matthew were raised by their mother. In 2000, Beth married George Jug Twitty, a prominent Alabama businessman, and the family moved to Mountain Brook, Alabama. Holloway graduated with honors in May of 2005 from Mountain Brook High School, located in a wealthy suburb of Birmingham. She was a member of the National Honor Society and the school dance squad and participated in other extracurricular activities. Holloway was scheduled to attend the University of Alabama on a full scholarship, where she planned to pursue a pre-med track. At the time of his daughter's disappearance, Dave Holloway was an insurance agent for State Farm in Meridian, Mississippi, and Beth Twitty was employed as the Mountain Brook Schools in the Mountain Brook school system. On Thursday, May 26, 2005, Holloway and 124 fellow graduates of Mountain Brook High School arrived in Aruba for a five-day unofficial graduation trip. The teenagers were accompanied by seven chaperones. According to the teacher and chaperone Bob Plummer, the chaperones met with the students each day to make sure everything was fine. Jody Bierman, who organized the trip, stated the chaperones were not supposed to keep up with their every move. Police Commissioner Gerald Domping, who headed the investigation from mid-05 to 06, stated that Mountain Brook students engaged in wild partying and a lot of drinking. Lots of room switching every night. We know the Holiday Inn told them they weren't welcome next year. Natalie, we know, she drank all day, every day. We have statements she started every morning with cocktails, so much drinking that Natalie didn't show up for breakfast two mornings. Two of Holloway's classmates, Liz Kane and Claire Fairman, agreed that the drinking was kind of excessive. Holloway was last seen by her classmates around 1:30 a.m. on Monday, May 30th, as she was leaving one of the bars in a nightclub, Carlos and Charlie's. She left in a car with 17-year-old Jordan Vandersloot, a Dutch honor student who was living in Aruba and attending the International School of Aruba, and his two Surinamese friends, brothers 21-year-old Deepak Kalapo, the owner of the car, and 18-year-old Satish Kalapo. Holloway was scheduled to fly home later that day, but she didn't appear for her return flight. Her packed luggage and her passport were found in her Holiday Inn room. Aruban authorities initiated searches for Holloway throughout the island and surrounding waters, but did not find her. Early investigations immediately following Holloway's missed flight, her mother and stepfather flew with friends to Aruba on a private jet. Within 4 hours of landing on the island, the Twitties presented the Aruban police with the name and address of Vandersloot, who was the person with whom Holloway left the nightclub. Beth stated that Vandersloot's full name was given to her by a night manager at the Holiday Inn, who supposedly recognized him on a videotape. The Twitties and their friends went to the Vandersloot home with two Aruban policemen to look for Holloway. Vandersloot initially denied knowing Holloway's name, but he then told the following story, which was corroborated by Deepak, who was present in the house. Vandersloot related that they drove Holloway to the California Lighthouse area of Arshi Beach because she wanted to see sharks. They later dropped Holloway off at her hotel at around 2 a.m. According to Vandersloot, Holloway fell down as she exited the car but refused his help. He stated that as he and Kalapo were driving away, Holloway was approached by a dark man in a black shirt similar to those worn by security guards. Carlos and Charlie's in Aruba. The restaurant was the last place Holloway was seen by her classmates. The search and rescue efforts for Holloway began immediately. Hundreds of volunteers from Aruba and the United States joined in the efforts. During the first days of the search, the Aruban government gave thousands of civil servants the day off to participate in the rescue effort. 50 Dutch Marines conducted an extensive search of the shoreline. Aruban banks raised $20,000 and provided other support to aid volunteer search teams. Beth Twitty was provided with housing initially at the Holiday Inn, where she coincidentally stayed in the same room her daughter had occupied. She subsequently stayed at the presidential suite of the nearby Wyndham Hotel. Reports indicated that Holloway did not appear on any nighttime surveillance camera footage of the hotel lobby. However, Twitty had made varying statements as to whether the cameras were operational that night. According to an April 19, 2006 statement made by Twitty, the video cameras at the Holiday Inn were not functioning the night Holloway vanished. Twitty has made other statements indicating that they were working and has stated so in her book. Police Commissioner Jan Vander Straten, the initial head of the investigation until his 2005 retirement, said that Holloway did not have to go through the lobby to return to her room. The search for physical evidence was extensive and subject to occasional false leads. For example, a possible blood sample taken from Deepak's car was tested and determined not to be blood. American law enforcement cooperated substantially with the Aruban authorities from the early days of the investigation. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice stated that reporters stated that the U.S. was in constant contact with Aruban authorities. Another State Department official indicated substantial resources are being applied to this as they continue to ask for more. On June 5th, Aruban police detained Nick John and Abraham Jones, former security guards in the nearby Allegro Hotel, which was in close to renovation, on suspicion of murder and kidnapping. Authorities have never officially disclosed the reason for their arrest, but according to news accounts, statements made by Vandersloot and Kelpo brothers may have been a factor in their arrests. Reports also indicated that the two former guards were known for cruising hotels to pick up women, and at least one of them had a prior incident with law enforcement. John and Jones were released on June 13th without being charged. On June 9th, Vandersloot and Kelpo brothers were arrested on suspicion of the kidnapping and murder of Holloway. Aruban law allows for investigators to make an arrest based on serious suspicion. In order to continue holding the suspect in custody, an increasing evidential burden must be met at periodic reviews. According to Dompig, the focus of the investigation centered on these three suspects from the get-go. Dompig stated that close observation of the three men began 3 days after Holloway was reported missing, and the investigation included surveillance, telephone wiretaps, and even monitoring of their email. Dompig indicated that pressure from Holloway's family caused the police to prematurely stop their surveillance and detain the three suspects. As the investigation continued, David Cruz, spokesman for the Aruban Minister of Justice, falsely indicated on June 11th that Holloway was dead and that the authorities knew the location of her body. Cruz later retracted the statement, saying he was a victim of a misinformation campaign. That evening, Dompig alleged that the Associated Press that one of the detained young men admitted something bad happened to Holloway after the suspects took her into the beach and that the suspect was leading police to the scene. The next morning, prosecution spokeswoman Vivian Van Der Biesen refused to confirm or deny the allegation, simply stating that the investigation was at a very crucial, very important moment. On June 17th, a sixth person, later identified as disc jockey Steve Gregory Crows, was also arrested. Vanderstraten told the media that Crows was detained based on information from one of the other three detainees. On June 22nd, Aruban police detained Vandersloot's father, Paulus Vandersloot, for questioning. He was arrested that same day. Both Paulus and Crows were ordered to be released on June 26th. During this period, the suspects who had been detained changed their stories. All three indicated that Vandersloot and Holloway were dropped off at the Marriott Hotel Beach near the fishermen's huts. Vandersloot stated that he did not harm Holloway, but left her on the beach. According to Status, Kalapo's attorney David Koch, Vandersloot called Deepak Kalapo to tell the latter that he was walking home and sent him a text message 40 minutes later. At some time during the interrogation, Vandersloot detailed a third account that he was dropped off at home and Holloway was driven off by Kalapo's brothers. Dompig discontinued the story, stating, "The latest story came when Vandersloot saw the other guys. The Kalapos were kind of finger-pointing in his direction, and he wanted to screw them also by saying he was dropped off. But that story doesn't check out at all. He just wanted to screw Deepak. Then, they had great arguments about this in front of the judge, because their stories didn't match. This girl, she was from Alabama. She's not going to stay in the car with two black kids. We believe the second story that they were dropped off by the Marriott." Following hearings before a judge, the Kalapo brothers were released on Monday, July 4th, but Vandersloot was detained for an additional 60 days. So it just kind of keeps going of let's talk to this person, let's talk to that person, as any investigation should. I guess one of the things that kind of amazes me, and, you know, I'm not saying it's wrong, but the amount of manpower and force that appeared to have been put into trying to find this girl, not only by the Aruban government and what they were trying to do to help the family, but the U.S. government as well. And they're in very large, in-depth look in trying to solve this case and trying to find her. I don't know that we put that much emphasis on finding a missing human being in our own country. Does it go up? Are the stakes that much higher when it's a foreign country? Or I'm just looking at level of resources and going, okay, well, then why, when we have a missing person case here, you can identify a lot of them that certainly do not get that level of attention. And I know there was some scrutiny about this at the point in time as well, of people looking at this going, well, it's a pretty young white girl. Is that why, you know, we had this extreme level of attention to it when you have children in our own country that may not be the pretty young white girl that get nowhere near that level of attention when they go missing?
Yeah, I didn't know of F-16s that fly over when there's somebody missing in Ohio.
I know.
Or farm this. I don't know if this is the United States wanting to look good. Oh, this is what we do for everyone.
He said F-16s. Absolutely. It's like, okay.
That yeah, and quite honestly, I don't know how these brothers and this Joran Vandersloot, how they were able to walk with all of their stories, and then they concoct this story. Oh, wait, no, this actually happened. I mean, can you keep someone detained for continuously lying? And just, but I'm not sure how the Arubian government works. That is astonishing how they were able to eventually be set free.
I mean, if their system, I mean, their system almost seems a little stricter than ours to the fact that you can detain someone just on strong suspicion with no evidence for long periods of time. Granted, there has to be benchmarks over and over that say there's more evidence here, but not quite a conviction. Wouldn't constantly changing your story suffice as being, that's more evidence there's something up here? Whether they killed her or not, they may know something, and maybe keeping them in custody for a long period of time, they'll come out and say, look, we were out by the lighthouse. She slipped and fell. We didn't ever see her again, and we didn't want to jump in there or whatever. You know, they fucked up morally somehow and didn't want to be blamed for a murder, so then they concocted these lies, or whatever it may be. I don't know. But, you know, it could be a road like that where people go and make up shit, you know, a lie for a lie, and then the lie ends up being much more damaging than just the original story of what actually happened. But I don't know. I mean, with the kid later getting convicted of murdering someone in another place, I don't know how if it's so much an accident as it is there was foul play involved here.
Well, and a little bit of talking where the one guy, they got into an argument with the brothers, so he almost wanted to make the brothers look worse than they initially were. Mm-hmm. It's just to be able to be known that you would do this, that you would go to hotels, that you would find girls so much that you would like to think that they could have come up with some piece of evidence that somebody doesn't just disappear out of thin air.
Yeah. Combing the waters, combing all that. I mean, you try and think of all the possibilities, and I'm sure this has been hashed over far greater than what we're doing on this show today. But you think of all the things that, okay, well, was she drunk? Did she pass it on the beach? Did the tide wash her out? Did she drown? I mean, that does happen. People can easily drown if they're drunk in water, you know, and then you don't find a body. I mean, did then something eat her in the ocean? I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of things that, and I don't know how, you know, plausible some of those things are, but when you have the people changing their stories, it seems that some know more than they're speaking to. Whether or not they killed her is another thing, but it seems some have more knowledge than they're willing to share. Let's continue on with the story of the disappearance of Natalie Holloway as we go into continued search, rearrests, and releases. On July 4th, the Royal Netherlands Air Force deployed 3 F-16 aircraft equipped with infrared sensors to aid in the search, but the results came up empty. In March of 2006, it was reported that satellite photos were being compared with photographs taken more recently, presumably from the F-16s, in an attempt to find unexpected shifts in ground that might be Holloway's grave. After a local gardener came forward with information, a small pond near the Aruba Racquet Club, close to the Marriott Hotel, was partially drained between July 27th and 30th of 05. According to Jug Twitty, the gardener claimed to have seen Vandersloot attempting to hide his face as he drove into the Racquet Club with Calipo Brothers on the very early morning of May 30th, between 2:30 a.m. and 3 a.m. Nancy Grace described the gardener as the man whose testimony cracks the case wide open. Another person, the jogger, claimed to have seen men burying a blonde-haired woman in a landfill during the afternoon of May 30th. The police had searched the landfill in the days following Holloway's disappearance. After the jogger's statements, the landfill was searched three more times. The FBI used cadaver dogs to assist in the recovery operation. However, the searches were, in fact, fruitless. Holloway's family initially offered $175,000, and donors offered $50,000 for her safe return. 2 months after her disappearance, the reward was increased from $200,000 to $1 million, with a $100,000 reward for information leading to the location of her remains. In August of 2005, the reward for information leading to Natalie's corpse was increased from $100,000 to $250,000. The FBI announced that Arubian authorities had provided its agency with documents, suspect interviews, and other evidence. Investigators found a piece of duct tape with strands of blonde hair attached to it. The samples were tested in a Dutch lab. A group from the Arubian Police and Prosecutor's Office then traveled to the FBI Central Laboratory in Quantico, Virginia, to consult with American investigators. The hair samples were tested a second time. The FBI announced that the hair samples did not belong to Holloway. The Calpo brothers were rearrested on August 26, along with another new suspect, 21-year-old Freddie Abramitz. Abramitz's lawyer said that his client was suspected of taking photographs of an underage girl and having inappropriate physical contact with the same girl. This incident allegedly occurred before the Holloway disappearance. Abramitz's friends, Vandersloot and Calpo brothers, were supposedly involved in the incident. Vandersloot's mother, Anita Vandersloot, stated, "It's a desperate attempt to get the boys to talk, but there's nothing to talk about." While no public explanation was then made for the Calpo rearrest, Duffing later said that it was an unsuccessful attempt to pressure the brothers into confessing. On September 3rd, the four detained suspects were released by a judge despite the attempts of the prosecution to keep them in custody. The suspects were released on the condition that they remain available to police. On September 14th, all restrictions on them were removed by the Combined Appeals Court of the Netherlands and Aruba. In the months following his release, Vandersloot gave several interviews that explained his version of the events. The most notable interview was broadcast on Fox News over three nights on March 2006. During the interview, Vandersloot indicated that Holloway wanted to have sex with him, but he did not because he didn't have a condom. He stated that Holloway wanted them to stay on the beach, but that he had to go to school in the morning. According to Vandersloot, he was picked up by Statish Kelpo at about 3 a.m. and left Holloway sitting on the beach. In August of 2005, David Koch, Kelpo's attorney, stated that his client had gone to sleep and had not returned to drive Vandersloot home. Vandersloot stated that he was somewhat ashamed to have left a young woman alone on the beach, albeit by her own request, and related that he was not truthful at first because he was convinced that Holloway would soon turn up. In January of 2006, the FBI and Arubian authorities interviewed, or in some cases re-interviewed, several of Holloway's classmates in Alabama. On January 17th, the Arubian police searched for Holloway's body in sand dunes on the northwest coast of Aruba, as well as areas close to the Marriott Beach. Additional searches took place in March and April of 2006 without result. Shortly before leaving the case, Duffing gave an interview to CBS in which he stated that he believed Holloway was not murdered, but probably died from alcohol and or drug poisoning, and that someone later hid her body. Dumping also stated that Aruba had spent about $3 million on the investigation, was about 40% of their operational police budget. Dumping indicated that there was evidence that pointed to possession, though not necessarily use, of illicit drugs by Holloway. Members of Holloway's family have denied that she used drugs. On April 11th of 2006, Dave Holloway published a book co-authored with R. Stephanie Good and Larry Garrison called Aruba, The Tragic Untold Story of Natalie Holloway and Corruption in Paradise, that recounted the search for his daughter. On April 15th, 2006, Jeffrey Van Cromvoret was arrested by Arubian authorities on suspicion of criminal offenses related to dealing in narcotics, which according to the prosecutor might have been related to the disappearance of Holloway. At his first court appearance, his detention was extended by 8 days. Van Cromvoret was released, however, on April 25th. In addition, another individual with initials AB was arrested on April 22nd, but was released the same day. On May 17th, another suspect, Gerardo Weaver, the son of a former Arubian politician, was detained in the Netherlands on suspicion of assisting in the abducting, battering, and killing of Holloway. Weaver was questioned for 6 days in Ucarat. Arubian prosecutors initially thought his transfer to the island, but he was instead released by agreement between the prosecutor and Weaver's attorney. At Aruba's request, the Netherlands took over the investigation following receipt of extensive case documentation in Rotterdam. A team of the Dutch National Police started work on the case in September. On April 16, 2007, a combined Arubian-Dutch team began pursuing the events investigation in Aruba. The book by Vandersloot and reporter Zivanda Virajic, Dizak Natalie Holloway, The Case of Natalie Holloway, was published in Dutch in April of 2007. In the book, Vandersloot gives his perspective of the night Holloway disappeared and the media frenzy that followed. He admits to and apologizes for his initial untruths, but maintains his innocence. On April 27th, a new search involving approximately 20 investigators was launched at the Vandersloot family residence in Aruba. Dutch authorities searched the yard and surrounding area using shovels and thin metal rods to penetrate the dirt. Prosecution spokeswoman Vander Biesen stated the investigation has never stopped and the Dutch authorities are completely reviewing the case for new indications. A statement from the prosecutor's police office related, "The team has indications that justify a more thorough search." Investigators did not comment on what prompted the new search, except that it was not related to Vandersloot's book. According to Paulus Vandersloot, nothing suspicious was found, and that was seized were diary entries of him and his wife and his personal computer, which were subsequently returned. According to Jossie Manser, managing editor of Aruba's Dario newspaper, investigators were following up on statements made during early suspect interrogations regarding communications between the Calipo brothers and Vandersloot. He also said investigators could be seen examining a laptop at the house. On May 12th, the Calipo family residence was searched by the authorities. The two brothers were detained for about an hour upon objecting to the entry by the police and Dutch investigators, but were released when the authorities left. According to Koch, the brothers objected to the search because officials did not show them an order justifying the intrusion. A statement from Vander Biesen did not mention what, if anything, officials were searching for, but indicated nothing was removed from the home. A subsequent statement from Het Openbaar Ministerie van Aruba, the Arubian prosecutor's office, indicated that the purpose of the visit was to get a better image of the place or circumstances where an offense may have been committed and to understand the chain of events leading to the offense. Citing what was described as newly discovered evidence, Arubian investigators re-arrested Vandersloot and the Calipo brothers on November 21, 2007, on suspicion of involvement in manslaughter and causing serious bodily harm that resulted in the death of Holloway. Vandersloot was detained by Dutch authorities in the Netherlands while the Calipo brothers were detained in Aruba. Vandersloot was returned to Aruba, where he was incarcerated. Soon after, Dave Holloway announced a new search for his daughter that probed the sea level beyond the original 330-foot depths in which earlier searches had taken place. That search involved a vessel called the Persistence and was abandoned due to lack of funds at the end of February of 2008, when nothing of significance was found. On November 30th, a judge ordered the release of the Calipo brothers, despite attempts by the prosecution to extend their detention. The brothers were released on the following day. The prosecution appealed their release, which was denied on December 5th, with the court writing, "Notwithstanding expensive and lengthy investigations on her disappearance and on people who could be involved, the file against the suspect does not contain direct indications that Natalie passed away due to a violent crime." Vandersloot was released without charge on December 7th due to lack of evidence implicating him, as well as a lack of evidence that Holloway died as a result of a violent crime. The prosecution indicated that it would not appeal. On December 18th, prosecutor Hans Moes officially declared the case closed and that no charges would be filed due to lack of evidence. The prosecution indicated a continuing interest in Vandersloot and that Calipo brothers, though they legally ceased to be suspects, and alleged that one of the three, in a chat room message, had stated that Holloway was dead. This was hotly contested by Deepak Calipo's attorney, who stated that the prosecution, in translating from one language to Dutch, had misconstrued a reference to a teacher who had drowned as one to Holloway. Attorney Ronald Wicks also stated, "Unless Moes finds a body of the bathroom of one of these, in the body of one of these kids, there's no way in hell they can arrest them anymore." Dutch television programs on January 31st of 2008, a crime reporter, Peter R. DeVers, claimed that he had solved the Holloway case. DeVers stated that he would tell all on a special television program on Dutch television on February 3rd. On February 1st, the Dutch media reported that Vandersloot made a confession regarding Holloway's disappearance. Later that day, Vandersloot stated that he was telling the individual what he wanted to hear and denied any involvement in her disappearance. That same day, the Aruba prosecutor's office announced the reporting, or the reopening, rather, of the case. The broadcast aired on February 3rd of 2008, including excerpts from footage recorded from hidden cameras and microphones in the vehicle of Patrick Vanderem, the Dutch businessman and ex-convict who gained Vandersloot's confidence. Vandersloot was seen smoking marijuana and stating that he was with Holloway when she began convulsively shaking, then became unresponsive. Vandersloot stated that he attempted to revive her without success. He said that he called a friend who told Vandersloot to go home and who disposed of the body. An individual reputed to be this friend, identified in the broadcast as Drury, was denied Vandersloot's account, indicating that he was in Rotterdam at school. The Arubian prosecutor's office attempted to obtain an arrest warrant for Vandersloot based on the tapes. However, a judge denied the request. The prosecutor appealed the denial, but the appeal failed on February 14th. The appeals court held that the statements on the tape were inconsistent with evidence in the case and were insufficient to hold Vandersloot. On February 8th, Vandersloot met with Arubian investigators in the Netherlands and denied that what he had said on the tape was true, stating that he was under the influence of marijuana at the time. Vandersloot indicated that he still maintains that he left Holloway behind on the beach. I don't know about you, but I'm going to say this, and maybe I'm going out on a limb, but marijuana doesn't make you admit to crimes you didn't commit. That's not usually one of the side effects of it, kill the person. You know, it doesn't typically work that way.
Marijuana usually makes you hungry. It may make you a little bit more relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
Never have I consumed marijuana and under the influence. Yeah, so in fourth grade, I took out my knife and killed someone on the playground because they didn't pick me first for kickball. Oh, no, officer. I was just high.
Especially a case that you are highly suspect in. It doesn't necessarily make you, I think, want to talk more about that. If there's nothing more to be talked about. There's just too much weirdness with the Vandersloot kid. There's one of two things going on there, in my opinion, of what we know thus far into the story from what we're reading here. Either A, he's clearly involved in some way, shape, or form, whether it was an accident, whether he killed her, whatever, something, or he's extremely mentally ill and is, you know, just saying shit left and right and really doesn't have a sense of what is right and wrong to be saying out loud.
But the only other thing that I think that could possibly be is he was somehow being blackmailed or somebody was going to take his life if he didn't say a certain script, which,
sure,
that was the case. That makes absolutely no sense why he continues to manipulate and change his stories. But getting back to a point, if you're not involved with something,
mm-hmm,
being under the influence of a narcotic, if anything, I would think you would be even more defiant and you would be even more irate of, I didn't do anything.
Yeah.
So it's just very astonishing and interesting that the fact that that was not held up in court or that didn't stick, the recorded calls, is because it didn't go along with evidence. Well, maybe it's new evidence.
Yeah.
How could it be in unison? Wow.
Here's something that I wonder about, and I don't know if it has come up in the case, and maybe we'll get to it. I have no idea. But there's such a focus here on these kids that were residing in that country. There has, to my knowledge, again, unless we get to it and I'm just not aware of it yet, Has there been a focus or an investigation or a look at anybody of the 100 some kids that went along on this trip, or chaperones, or just anybody that went back to the States as possibly being involved or with her or anything there that could point to any sort of information? You know, I know like it seemed like a pretty solid lead at first with these kids, but they kept coming up empty handed left and right. Do they? I would think they would look at all that, but if everybody says no and everybody has an alibi, I guess maybe there's no road to go down there.
And there's no talk of what is being done back in the States of anybody being investigated. It's all the Arubian government and the United States helping out over there, opposed to back here.
Yeah, there seems to be a little. I don't know. Maybe I'm completely off base, but there, you know, obviously there's some powerful parents involved here, and it makes me wonder to a certain extent of, is there some influence saying, you know, let's push here, let's really investigate over there. You know, and I'm also interested to hear what the allegations of corruption are against Aruba from the parents in their book, because from everything we've heard thus far, they seem to be fairly cooperative and going out on to great depths to try and solve this. It wasn't like, oh, missing girl, no big deal, it happens all the time. Next, you know, it seems like they invested, like they said, 40% of their police budget into this one case. So maybe there's more to it that I'm not aware of. But I'm wondering, you know, with all that pushing and all that extra force that's going behind this case, looking over there, have they been looking in the wrong place the whole time, or are they really just so sure that this Vandersloot has something to do with it that they're just being relentless at him?
Which is astonishing and makes no sense, where they continue to push on him, but every new lead they find to match him to the murderer, they throw the case out or they let him walk.
Yeah. It's confusing at the least to try and figure this one out, which I guess is why it's still an unsolved mystery. Let's continue in with the story. In March of 2008, news reports indicated that Vander M was secretly taped after giving an interview for Arubian television. Vander M, under the impression that cameras had been turned off, disclosed that he had been a friend of Vandersloot for years, contradicting his statement on DeVry's show that he had met Vandersloot in 07. That he expected to become a millionaire through his involvement in the Holloway case, and that he knew the person who supposedly disposed of Holloway's body, and that Vandersloot had asked him for 2,000 euros to buy the man silence. According to Dutch news service ANP, Vander M, who had already signed a book deal, was furious after learning of the taping and threatened the interviewer, who sought legal advice. Vander M's book, Overboard, co-written with E.E. Byers, was released in Dutch on June 25th. Vander M was arrested on December 13th in the Netherlands for allegedly hitting his girlfriend with a crowbar and engaging in risky driving behavior while fleeing police. The DeVry's broadcast was discussed in a seminar by Dutch legal psychologist William Albert Wagner, who indicated that the statements did not constitute a confession. Wagner criticized DeVry's for broadcasting the material, stating that the broadcast made it harder to obtain a conviction. And had DeVry's turned over the material to the authorities without broadcasting it, they would have held all the trumps. In questioning Vandersloot, Wagner opinion that not only was the case not solved, it was not even clear that a crime had been committed. Professor Chrissy Brantz at the same seminar also criticized DeVry's methods. On November 24th, Fox News aired an interview with Vandersloot in which he alleged that he sold Holloway into sexual slavery, receiving money both when Holloway was taken and later on to keep quiet. Vandersloot also alleged that his father paid off two police officers who had learned that Holloway was taken to Venezuela. Vandersloot later retracted the statements made in the interview. Fox News also aired part of the audio recording provided by Vandersloot, which he alleged is a phone conversation between him and his father in which the father displays knowledge of his son's purported involvement in human trafficking. According to Moes, the voice heard on the recording is not that of Paulus Vandersloot. The Dutch newspaper, De Telegraaf, reported that the father's voice is almost certain that of Jordan Vandersloot himself, trying to speak in a lower tone. Paulus died of a heart attack on February 10th of 2010. On March 20th, 2009, Dave Holloway transported a search dog to Aruba to search a small reservoir in the northern part of the island. The reservoir was previously identified by a supposed witness as a possible location of Natalie's remains. Arubian authorities indicated that they had new information in the case, but that Holloway had been given permission to conduct the search. On February 23, 2010, it was reported that Vandersloot had stated in an interview first offered to RTL Group in 2009 that he had disposed of Holloway's body in a marsh area on Aruba. New Chief Prosecutor Peter Blanken indicated that authorities had investigated the latest story and had dismissed it. Blanken stated that the locations, names, and times he gave just did not make sense. In March of 2010, underwater searches were conducted by Arubian authorities after an American couple reported that they were snorkeling when they photographed what they thought might be human skeletal remains, possibly those of Holloway. Arubian authorities sent divers to investigate, but no remains were ever recovered. Vandersloot's extortion of the Holloway family. On March 29, 2010, Vandersloot contacted John Q. Kelly, Beth Twitty's legal representative, with an offer to reveal the location of Holloway's body and the circumstances surrounding her death if he were given advances of $25,000 against a total of $250,000. After Kelly notified the FBI, they arranged to proceed with the transaction. On May 10th, Vandersloot had a $15,000 wire transferred to his account in the Netherlands. Following the receipt of $10,000 in cash that was videotaped by undercover investigators in Aruba, authorities stated that the information that he provided in return was false because the house in which he said Holloway's body was located had not yet been built at the time of her disappearance. On June 3rd, Vandersloot was charged in the U.S. District Court of Northern Alabama with extortion and wire fraud. U.S. Attorney Joyce White Vance obtained an arrest warrant and transmitted it to Interpol. On June 30th, Vandersloot was indicted on the charges. At the request of the U.S. Justice Department, authorities conducted a June 4th raid and confiscated items from two homes in the Netherlands. One of the homes belonged to reporter Jaap Ames, who had previously interviewed Vandersloot and claimed knowledge of his criminal activities. Arubian investigators used information gathered from the extortion case to launch a new search at a beach, but no new evidence was found. Dave Holloway returned to Aruba on June 14th to pursue possible new clues. Vandersloot's murder of Stephanie Flores Ramirez in Peru. On May 30th, 2010, 5 years to the day after Holloway's disappearance, Stephanie Flores Ramirez, a 21-year-old business student, was reported missing in Lima, Peru. She was found dead 3 days later in a hotel room, registered to Vandersloot's name. On June 3rd, Vandersloot was arrested in Chile on a murder charge and extradited to Peru the next day. On June 7th, Peruvian authorities said that Vandersloot confessed to killing Flores after he lost his temper because she accessed his laptop without permission and found information linking him to Holloway. Police Chief Cesar Guerrera related that Vandersloot told Peruvian police that he knew where Holloway's body was and offered to help Peruvian authorities find it. However, Guerrera stated that the interrogation was limited to their case in Peru, that questions about Holloway's disappearance were avoided. On June 11th, Vandersloot was charged in Lima Superior Court with first-degree murder and robbery. On June 15th, Arubian and Peruvian authorities announced an agreement to cooperate and allow investigators from Aruba to interview Vandersloot at Miguel Castro Prison in Peru. On September 2010, an interview from prison, Vandersloot reportedly admitted to the extortion plot, stating, "I wanted to get back at Natalie's family. His parents have been making my life tough for 5 years. On January 11, 2012, Vandersloot pled guilty to murdering Flores and was sentenced to 28 years in prison. In June of 2011, 6 years after Natalie's disappearance, Dave Holloway filed a petition with the Alabama courts to have his daughter declared legally dead. The papers were served to his ex-wife, Beth Twitty, who announced her intention to oppose the petition. A hearing was held on September 23, 2011, at which time probate judge Alan King ruled that Dave Holloway had met the requirements for a legal presumption of death. On January 12, 2012, a second hearing was held, after which Judge King signed the order declaring Natalie Holloway to be dead. On November 12, 2010, tourists found a jawbone on an Arubian beach near the Phoenix Hotel and Bulabai Swamp. Preliminary examination by a forensic expert determined that the bone was from a young woman. A part of the bone was sent to the Hague for testing by the Netherlands Forensic Institute. On November 23rd of 2010, Aruba Solicitor General Tako Stein announced that based on dental records, the jawbone was not of Holloway, and it was not even possible to determine whether it had come from a man or a woman. In 2016, Dave Holloway hired a private investigator, T.J. Ward, to once more go through all the evidence and information related to the disappearance of his daughter. This led to an informant, Gabrielle, who claimed to have been a roommate of one of Vandersloot's closest friends, American John Ludwig, in 2005. Gabrielle claimed that Ludwig was told what became of Natalie. In an interview with the Oxygen television channel, Gabrielle gave a detailed description of what happened to the night of Natalie's disappearance. Oxygen created a new documentary series on Natalie's disappearance that aired August 19th of 2017. Using Gabrielle's information, the investigator had found what happened to be human bones. On October 3rd of 2017, DNA testing concluded that one piece of bone was human, but did not belong to Natalie. On the show, Ludwig claimed to have helped Vandersloot dig up, smash, and cremate Holloway's bones in 2010. In February of 2018, Elizabeth Holloway sued the producers, alleging this and other claims are fictional and harmfully lurid, and that she was misled into providing a DNA sample for a comparison without being made aware of plans for a show. In March of 2018, Ludwig was stabbed to death by a woman he tried to kidnap. The Twitties and their supporters criticized a perceived lack of progress by Arubian police. The Twitties' own actions in Aruba were also criticized, and the Twitties were accused of actively stifling any evidence that might impugn Holloway's character by asking her fellow students to remain silent about the case and using their access to the media to push their own version of events. The Twitties denied this. In televised interviews and in the book, Beth Twitty alleges that Vandersloot and the Calipo brothers knew more about Holloway's disappearance than they have told authorities, and that at least one of them sexually assaulted or raped their daughter. On July 5th, 2005, following the initial release of the Calipos, Twitty alleged two suspects were released yesterday who were involved in a violent crime against my daughter and referred to the Calipos as criminals. A demonstration involving about 200 Arubians took place that evening outside a courthouse. The protesters were angry over Twitty's remarks, with signs reading, "Innocent until proven guilty," and "Respect our Dutch laws or go home." Satish Calipo's attorney threatened legal action and described Twitty's allegations as prejudicial, inflammatory, libelous, and totally outrageous. On July 8th of 2005, Twitty read a statement that said her remarks were fueled by despair and frustration, and that she apologized to the Arubian police and to the Arubian authorities if I or my family offended you in any way. In her 2007 book, Loving Natalie, A Mother's Testament of Hope and Faith, Twitty wrote that, "What we want is, we want justice. And you know, we have to recognize the fact that, you know, the crime has been committed on the island of Aruba, and we know the perpetrators. We know it's these suspects, Deepak and Satish Calipo and Jordan Vandersloot. And you know, we just have to, though, keep going, Nancy, because the only way we will get justice for Natalie is if we do keep going. I mean, if we give up, absolutely nothing will happen. Nothing." Following the airing of the De Vries program on Dutch television, Twitty adhered to the position that the tapes represented the ways events transpired and told the New York Post that she believed her daughter still might be alive if Vandersloot had called for help. She contended that Vandersloot had dumped Holloway's body, possibly alive, into the Caribbean Ocean. Twitty also alleged that the person Vandersloot supposedly called that evening was his father, Paulus, who, according to Twitty, orchestrated what to do next. Holloway's parents alleged that Vandersloot was receiving special legal favors after the court decision not to rearrest Vandersloot was affirmed. Twitty stated, "I think that what I do take comfort in, his life is a living hell." Later adding, "I'd be good with a midnight express prison anywhere for Jordan." In response to her daughter's disappearance, Twitty found the International Safe Travels Foundation, a nonprofit organization designed to inform and educate the public to help them travel more safely as they travel internationally. In May of 2010, she announced that the Natalie Holloway Resource Center would open at the National Museum in Crime Punishment, located in Washington, D.C. The center opened on June 8th to aid families of missing people. Holloway's family initially discouraged a travel boycott of Aruba, but this changed by September of 2005. Twitty urged that people not travel to Aruba and other Dutch territories because of what she stated were tourist safety issues. On November 8, 2005, a news conference, Governor Bob Riley and the Holloways urged Alabamans and others to boycott Aruba. Riley also wrote to other United States governors seeking their support. The governors of Georgia and Arkansas eventually joined in the call for a boycott. Philadelphia City Council voted to ask the Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell to call for a boycott. Rendell did not do so, and no federal support was given. The boycott was supported by some of Alabama's congressional delegation, including both senators and Representative Spencer Baucus, who represents Mountain Brook. Senator Richard Shelby voiced his support for the boycott in a letter to the American Society of Travel Agents. Shelby stated, "For the safety, security, and well-being of our citizens, I do not believe that we can trust that we will be protected while in Aruba." Prime Minister Obadiah stated that Arubian investigators have done their best to solve the case and responded to the call for a boycott. "This is a preposterous and impossible act. We are not guerrillas. We are not terrorists. We don't pose a threat to the United States nor to Alabama." Members of the Aruba Hotel and Tourism Association, the Aruba Tourism Industry, the Aruba Hospitality and Security Foundation, the Arubian Chamber of Commerce, and government figures, including Public Relations Representative Ruben Trappenberg, formed an Aruba Strategic Communications Task Force to respond collectively to what they perceive to be unfounded and or negative portrayals of the island. The group issued press releases and sent representatives to appear in news media. They joined the Aruba government in opposing the calls for a boycott of the island. So, it continues.
Wow.
A lot of information there. To me, I don't know, I feel like there's something going on here to push people in other directions. Whether it's to hide something of the character of Natalie, whether it's something to hide someone's knowledge of what's going on beyond that of the Vandersloot, whose story changes every time he's interviewed. I don't know. It's insanely confusing, and there's not a lot of dots to connect because the dots keep moving on you.
I have gone cross-eyed about 17 times in listening to or thinking that there was actually going to be a break in the case, but I don't know enough about the legal system to be able to pinpoint and actually incarcerate this person. Mm-hmm. So I am absolutely clueless as to what could be happening here, short of some type of conspiracy theory. Do you think she's still alive?
Doubtful, but as to how she died, I am no more closer to knowing that or having any suspicion on that than when we started.
It's interesting that on two different occasions, a dead body or fragments of a dead body was found. Oh yeah, that's a dead person. I mean, that's not the dead person we're looking for, but you found a dead person, you found a jawbone. Well done. What happens there? Do you then look into who that is?
It seems like those just kind of brushed off. It's like, it's not the one we want, so let's just put it back on the shelf.
Move along.
Yeah. I don't know. It's very bizarre. There's one little bit left here about the Skeeter's tape and a Dr. Phil interview and some lawsuits. So let's see where this takes us as we get into the last end piece of this episode here of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. On September 15th, 2005, the Dr. Phil television show showed parts of a hidden camera interview with Deepak Kalapo, in which he seemingly affirmed a suggestion that Holloway had sex with all three men. The taping had been instigated by Jamie Skeeters, a private investigator. When the tape was broadcast, news reports indicated an expectation of a rearrest, with Domping termed a strong possibility if the tapes were legitimate. Subsequently, Arubian police provided a fuller version of the relevant part of the tape, in which Kalapo's response differed from the Dr. Phil version, apparently due to editing that may have altered the meaning of what was said. An unofficial Arubian-affiliated spokesperson and commentator on the case said that the uncut videotape showed that Kalapo had shaken his head and said, "No, she didn't," thereby denying that Holloway had sex with him and the other two men. According to an MSNBC report, the crucial words are inaudible, and presenter Rita Cosby questioned if it could be substantiated that Kalapo had ever made the statements attributed to him in the Dr. Phil version of the recording. In December of 2006, the Calipos filed a slander and libel suit against Skeeters, who died in January of 2007, and Dr. Phil in Los Angeles, California. Holloway's parents responded by filing a wrongful death lawsuit against the Calipos in the same venue. The wrongful death suit was dismissed for lack of personal jurisdiction on June 1, 2007. The libel and slander case was initially set for trial on October 12, 2011, but later set for April of 2015. An earlier suit had been filed in New York City by Holloway's parents against Jordan and Paulus Vandersloot and served them on a visit to New York. The case had been dismissed in August of 2006 and filed as an inconvenient forum. On November 10th of 2005, Paulus Vandersloot won an unjust detention action against the Arubian government, clearing him as a suspect and allowing him to retain his government contract. The elder Vandersloot then brought a second action seeking monetary damages for himself and his family because of his false arrest. The action was initially successful, but the award of damages was reversed on appeal. The Amigo newspaper reported on interviews with Julia Renfro and Domping, in which they said that the Arubian authorities had been systematically obstructing their investigation by U.S. officials. They also said that within a day of Holloway being reported missing, a medjet unauthorized by Arubian authorities had arrived in Aruba and had remained for several days for the purpose of covertly taking Holloway off the island without notifying local authorities. Renfro, an American-born editor of the English-language daily Aruba Today, who at the time of Holloway's disappearance had become close friends with Twitty, also said that she and Twitty received a phone call from an unknown woman on June 2nd, 2005, asking for money in return for information about Holloway's location and asserting that Holloway was unwilling to return to her mother. According to Renfro, she and another American went to a drug house where Holloway supposedly was, bringing money, but found that Jug Twitty had already been to the area, spreading a lot of uproar and panic in the direct vicinity, and nothing could be accomplished. The Twitties disputed Renfro's accounts, and Beth Twitty described Renfro as a witch. U.S. television networks devoted substantial on-air time to the search for Holloway, the investigation of her disappearance, and rumors surrounding the case. Greta Van Susteren, then host of Fox News On the Record, and Nancy Grace of her show Headline News, her Headline News program, were amongst the most prominent television personalities to devote time to the incident. Van Susteren's almost continuous coverage of the story garnered On the Record its best ratings to date, while Grace's show became the cornerstone of the new Headline Prime block on Headline News, which ran two episodes, a live show, and a repeat every night during the primetime. As the case wore on, much of the attention was given to Beth Twitty and her statements. Arubian government spokesman Ruben Trappenberg stated, "The case is under a microscope, and the world is watching." The saturation of coverage triggered a backlash among some critics, who argue that such extensive media attention validated the missing white woman syndrome theory, which argues that a missing person case involving white women and girls receive disproportionately more attention in the media compared with cases involving males or people of color. CNN ran a segment criticizing the amount of coverage their competitors gave to the story, despite that they characterized as a lack of new items to report, with CNN news anchor Anderson Cooper calling the coverage downright ridiculous. Early in the case, political commentator and columnist Ariana Huffington wrote, "If you were to get your news only from television, you'd think the top issue facing our country right now is an 18-year-old girl named Natalie who went missing in Aruba. Every time one of these stories comes up, like, say, Michael Jackson, when it's finally over, I think, what a relief. Now we can get back to real news, but we never do." In March of 2008, Alderaro commented, "But if doubts persist about cases involving missing Latinos, there are reasons why. These cases rarely receive the attention and resources we see given to other missing persons. The English language media, for example, appear to be focused on the stories of missing white women, such as with the disappearance of Natalie Holloway in Aruba. Cases of missing Latino and African American women often remain faceless, if and when they are ever covered." CBS senior journalist Dana Walker stated, "There is criticism that it is only a story because she is a pretty blonde and white, and it is criticism that journalists are taking to heart and looking elsewhere for other stories. But it is a big story because it is an American girl who went off on an adventure and didn't come back. It's a huge mystery. It's something people can identify with." Good Morning America anchor Chris Cuomo was unapologetic of his program's extensive coverage of the Holloway case, stating, "I don't believe it's my role to judge what people want to watch. If they say, I want to know what happened to this girl, I want to help them find out." Holloway's family, however, took the opposite approach and criticized The lessening of coverage of her disappearance due to a shift in news priority when Hurricane Katrina struck on August 23rd of 05. The saturation coverage of Holloway's disappearance was finally eclipsed by the hurricane. Beth Twitty and Dave Holloway alleged that Aruba took advantage of the extensive coverage of Hurricane Katrina to release their suspects. However, the deadline for judicial review of Vandersloot's detention was set long before Katrina. Hurricane Katrina had left the door open for the boys to be sent to their way with little publicity and few restrictions because it took the world's focus off Natalie. This according to Dave Holloway in his book. But only for a brief time. The huge amount of publicity had waned, and during that time of quiet for us, Jordan and Calipo brothers were sent home. All the news shows that had followed our every move only a day before had now become fixated on the next big ratings grabber, the victims of Hurricane Katrina. So Hurricane Katrina eventually eclipses the story and kind of gets a bit more coverage. And yeah, I understandably so. But I would agree. I think it was, I mean, it's a horrible thing. It's not to say that this was a good thing or anything by any stretch of the imagination. But yeah, I mean, there was a ton of coverage about it. But is it, here's where we got to look at it from the public perception and people loving to attack and make a villain out of the media. The media presents what the public wants to see. How? Ratings. If they're seeing that a story or something is getting good ratings, it's going to tell them, oh, people want to hear more about this. So they keep reporting on it. And when it keeps happening over and over and over, they're going to keep going with what is getting the most ratings. Now, is that accurate or is that good for getting accurate news? No, it's not. It's not at all. Because usually what gets the most ratings are sometimes the least of important of events that affect all of us. And people naturally are hungry for, you know, kind of the lowest common denominator type news where it's dark, salacious stuff. Not necessarily something that's going to affect all of our lives because of changes with the local school board. They'd rather focus on this. So is it the media's fault for following along with what gets ratings? I'm not going to answer that because I don't know what the answer is. But that is how we get it. It's not necessarily some reporter there going, I'm obsessed with this and I'm never going to stop talking about this. It's because it's getting ratings and people are watching. If the people didn't give a shit or the public at large said, okay, enough, it would fade out as well. And it naturally does in many cases. Sometimes it takes a hurricane to move on to something else. Sometimes it takes a pandemic. It took 9/11 for us to get off of Britney Spears wearing a snake around her self. And I don't even remember. Was it Chandra Levy? The case with there was a senator or something at the time that was a big hoopla that was going on. And then suddenly all that boom out of the water. Because it got eclipsed by something else. But is it the media's fault for reporting on what the people are showing they want to hear more of? Because just as soon as the media says, we're not going to report on this, you're going to be bombarded at the media outlet with, why aren't you reporting on this? It's kind of a no-win situation in many cases.
There's a saying, if it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah.
It is appalling. And for example, local news, it's murders and murders and murders and murders and murders. Yes, it is tragic, but everybody wants to see it. You drive by, that's why there's traffic reports when they say rubbernecking or gawker delays. It's because if there's a car accident on the other side of the interstate when you're driving 70, you're gonna look.
Yeah.
It's not something that you hoped happened, but tragedy is something that is spurs curiosity. People are interested. People almost become obsessed. Mm-hmm. So it is not to say that we're going to change and that we want to see a squirrel on water skis all day, every day, leading the newscast. But it is what we want. And there are proven results that show that you can monetize and revenue and news broadcasts because they have commercials. And that's mm-hmm. how it all works. But it's very interesting. If that hurricane had not happened, would the tale continue on and the news source and cycle, would we still be talking about the disappearance of her?
I think it would fade. I think it was already on its last legs, quite honestly. In terms of what they were able to dig up and find. And I'm not trying to make a weird pun there, but there just wasn't any more leads to go on. And the people who were all the, it seems that most of the leads, quote unquote, they were getting were just lies made up by Vandersloot to get attention or to try and extort money out of people. So, you know, as far as legitimate leads that this case actually had were very few. Because he kept changing the story and kept making something new up. And eventually the authorities, I think, said, bullshit, whatever you tell us, you're trying, it's an ulterior motive here. But does that mean he's innocent? I don't think so. I think he knows more than we are aware of. But are we ever going to get to know the answer to that? I don't know. If I was that dad, you know, it's one of those, let's put ourselves in the shoes of someone like that. I mean, I can't contemplate what that must feel like. But I know if in my case, and I'm not saying he should have done this because he'd probably be in jail too. But if in my case, if this happened with my daughter, I wouldn't be just showing up to an island with extra dogs. I would be showing up, conspiring with people on the island for weaponry, getting the suspects in a room cornered and having my own interrogation if I'm believing that there's more information that this person is holding back on. And trust me, information would come out one way or another, or someone would be coming out of there dead. I think that's how I would end up handling it, quite honestly.
That's a whole different perspective, and I think we can do a show in and of itself on the topic of if this was a situation, put yourself in the parent's situation, what you would do, how you would handle it. Yes, this is what happened. Yes, this is a timeline. Yes, there's all these opportunities where only if this could have been done or this could have been asked, what you would do. Yeah. I mean, what Law and Order scene, interrogation room, close the blinds, get the battery cables out, get whatever you do to torture someone into telling you information.
And I don't know that that's, you know, that's certainly it's not right. It should never be done or used. But if it were my daughter, I mean, when you're in that sort of a situation, when you're a parent, I don't know that I would be able to hold myself back if there's this obvious of a suspect there that keeps changing information. Even just the fucking changing of information and fucking with the family would be enough, I think, to push me over the edge to go, you know what? I've lived a long, good life. You're fucking around with this thing and fucking around with the name of my daughter, whether you killed her or not. Guess what? I'm coming for you, motherfucker. That would be my outlook. But, you know, that would be assuming I'm going to get caught then and go to jail too. Maybe it's not what he wanted to do. I know his interest is in finding his daughter, and I do not fault him on that at all. But after so long and not finding any evidence, and it's only so long that, you know, you're going to pick up stuff with dogs and equipment like that, and this fucker is out there making up stories, trying to make money, I'm going to go after that fucker no matter what. Because that to me is just like just a disgrace of humanity to sit there and be saying shit like that and fucking with people who are trying to deal with a daughter who is missing and likely dead. And you're a prime suspect. If you're a suspect and you were found innocent, then shut the fuck up and move on. Don't be sitting around trying to cash in on this shit show. I mean, if you're going to do your book deal or whatever, do your fucking book deal. But quit making up shit on television and then saying, oh, I didn't mean it. Like, fuck you. Like, it's done for you, my friend. That would be how I would handle it. But anyway.
There's a lot of people that have a little bit more patience than others don't.
Yeah.
And I would be in that same boat as a fellow inmate for a situation like that happened. Yeah, fuck you, local law enforcement. I don't much care. I am going to do my darndest to get information. Yeah. Arrest me. Do whatever you need to do, but I'm going to do
what I need to do.
Wild goose chase.
Yeah, I mean, and I would certainly give, and they gave them their time to do it. But as this continued on, and the shit that kid was saying over and over, that's where I think that's what would drive a parent insane, or would certainly drive me as a parent insane to probably do shit that would get me in jail. But I certainly respect trying to do the right thing and let the law do its thing. And if it does the right thing and it turns out you get information, great. But if you keep getting this fucker that keeps making shit up, and you keep arresting him and he keeps doing like that, that to me is where I'm like, no go there. So anyway, that's today's episode, the disappearance of Natalie Holloway. On the dark side of Wikipedia. If you like our show, please support it. Give us a review there on Apple Podcasts. Leave us a positive review. We greatly appreciate that. Until next time, for Sean, I'm Tony, and all of us at Dark Side of Wikipedia, thanks for listening.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 million protection package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Hi there, my name's Andy.
And my name's Anna.
And we are two of the four hosts of the podcast No Such Thing as a Fish. We present every week the most amazing, wonderful, insane, hilarious, bizarre facts you've ever heard.
Facts like, did you know America has a national grocery bag packing competition?
Did you know, Anna, the company Volkswagen sells more sausages than it does cars?
Yes, we've got those two facts and about a billion more in our podcast archives for you to listen to. We chat about them, we laugh about them, we make the occasional terrible pun.
It's great fun. It's called No Such Thing as a Fish. Why don't you listen now?
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. Workplace stress is now a leading cause of declining mental health, with 61% of the global workforce feeling it more than ever. You can't escape work, but you can take small steps to care for yourself. A walk, some sun, a favorite song. Therapy is one of those steps. Ongoing support to build resilience for whatever your day throws at you. Balance is tough. Getting help shouldn't be. Visit BetterHelp.com today for 10% off your first month.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 million protection package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 million protection package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Hi there, my name's Andy.
And my name's Anna.
And we are two of the four hosts of the podcast No Such Thing as a Fish. We present every week the most amazing, wonderful, insane, hilarious, bizarre facts you've ever heard.
Facts like, did you know America has a national grocery bag packing competition?
Did you know, Anna, the company Volkswagen sells more sausages than it does cars?
Yes, we've got those two facts and about a billion more in our podcast archives for you to listen to. We chat about them, we laugh about them, we make the occasional terrible pun.
It's great fun. It's called No Such Thing as a Fish. Why don't you listen now?